All right, so we'll start out with a simple question. Or more to the point, an idea. Jesus used, somewhat interchangeably, two phrases, kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven. We use them so frequently that maybe they've lost their meaning. Not only that, but we don't have a lot of kingdoms today. I mean, there are some. There's a few small oil-rich countries in the Middle East that still refer to themselves as kingdoms. But for the most part, we don't have kingdoms. So when Jesus describes things and says, the kingdom of heaven is like, how does he want to be understood? That's the big question. So let's start out with a few assumptions that we don't maybe understand. And so we're going to put two things up here. King. Kingdom. What is unique about a king? What distinguishes a king from other forms of leadership?
He's the final say. He's the only say. Or, yeah.
We'll put both. Only in final, and I'll just authority. Okay, what else?
Makes all the rules. Well, I guess we can include that.
That's a rich point all on its own. We'll come back to that. Dig a little deeper.
And he judges. He's also judges.
Okay. So he is the rule maker and he is the rule arbiter. He decides if people have crossed the line.
What's that? Judge, jury, and executioner.
The highest leader. The highest leader.
The highest? Is that what you're saying? Okay. I want you to think king on earth. Remember, we're not rushing ahead. Remember, Jesus intended us to understand some things. Anything else?
Specific area in which he dwells.
Okay, ties right into there. All right, we'll come back to that.
He's together with the crown.
One final thing. Okay, let's compare these two words. Leader and king. How are they similar? And how are they different? Okay. Let me introduce it a different way. President and king. How are they the same, but how are they different?
The leader or president provides guidance. As other people, he's not absolute. The king is.
Okay.
Well, he's the leader. If you want to get the definition, he is the top of the executive branch. He's the one who decides what laws are good, what laws aren't good, the ones that need to be changed. Doesn't necessarily have the power to change them. He's the one who dictates what should be changed, shouldn't be changed. He's the one that everyone is supposed to look up to and say, okay, I aspire to. This guy has wisdom and knowledge, and we need to follow his leadership in the future.
Okay.
Yeah, leadership, but he's not absolute final authority.
Let me pose the question in a different way. Scott.
You're asking the president and leader?
Yeah, are there any differences?
The president is an appointed position. The leader is someone people follow. He has people that are going to respect and do what he wants to do.
Okay, an important point, not quite where we're going. From whom?
He's a king.
Okay.
A leader and president.
Right.
A leader and president?
Well, or a. And when it was. When you weren't grasping it then I said, well, let's try president.
I thought you said president.
From where does a president's authority originate?
Position.
From the people.
From the people. From where does a king's authority originate?
From God.
Okay, and it's a bloodline, isn't it?
Yeah, from his lineage.
So a king acquires his kingship in one of only a few ways. What are some of those ways?
Bloodline.
Yes, he's born into it. He's born into it, that makes him an heir, is born into the situation, it's a particular bloodline, or?
Forceful takeover.
Well, forceful takeover, there you go. So a king derives his authority either from his own might, whether it's just or not, but as we've already decided, a king makes the rules. So if a king decides that he wants to acquire new lands, and he's the one who makes the rules, is it okay for him to acquire new lands? Is that just? Of course it is, because he makes the rules.
Well, you're saying that in very casual fashion. It doesn't make it right.
No, but it's human, earthly fashion. Yeah.
It doesn't make it right, but we're just...
He's allowed to.
Well,
he has... Earth, you're allowed to do whatever you want.
Okay.
As long as you're willing to accept the circumstance, the consequences, you can do whatever you want.
All right. So a king acquires his power from one of two ways. He either takes it or it's passed on to him by bloodline. All right, now we're going to introduce the word kingdom.
I'm sure there would have been at least one king that was voted in by a group of leaders who said, we need a king. We need somebody to run this thing. It's not working. And they voted a king. Now what happened from there, who knows? But...
Okay. Valid point. So there is a continuum, we'll say, from what we'll call the despot who decides what he wants to do and does whatever he pleases and stays there as long as... Well, even in the scriptures, you can see how king lines of kingship are interrupted. What happens?
Oh, God usually puts one of them in their place.
Okay, forget biblical times. Let's just look at Central America and South America. Have we seen...
Or even back in England, in those early years, you know, 1,000 years ago or so, that's the way that it was, you know, usurping authority, you know, the brother has the right to the throne, but the other brother wants the throne.
So I can't keep everything on the board at the same time, so we're going to have to move on. Okay, so a king and his kingdom. So what's the kingdom?
Whatever area he controls.
Territory. His rule.
He has authority over a specific amount of area. That's his kingdom.
Okay, so territory. What else? Because you've already alluded to the second thing. You said whatever he has authority over.
His people.
There you go. So a king needs two things. He needs territory, and he needs subjects. So if he has territory but no subjects, he's basically just a glorified landowner, right? You own territory.
I am the king of my domain.
Until your wife comes home, yes, that's true.
Sometimes it feels like a slave.
Yes, my queen.
Well, John, if that's true, then it's because you don't have the right subjects in your realm.
I don't have any subjects.
Okay, so these are the two primary things that a king needs, both territory and subjects. If he has subjects but no territory, he has nowhere to practice his authority. And if he has territory but no subjects, he has no one to practice his authority on. All right, so what distinguishes then, so now we're going to get into some of what Jim talked about. So keep in mind, this is a phrase that Jesus used, king, kingdom. So we're looking for hints as to what Jesus means by that. Keep in mind everything that we talked about. Kingship is a function of either power or bloodline. A king needs both people and a place in order to practice his rule. Now let's talk about righteousness. A king has a couple of different options. So when you think of, and now we're going to introduce an adjective, a good or a noble king, what does the king do? What distinguishes a good king from one who isn't? So we're going to broaden the lens a little bit.
Watches over them.
Okay, it really gets down to one simple question. Why am I the king? What is the purpose to my kingship? And so every king has one basic question to ask in relationship to the people. Do the people exist for my purpose and benefit, or does my position exist to protect and care for them? That's the ultimate value, and every king answers it differently.
Right.
We know we can look back through history and see kings who said, the subject's job is to make me happy. John just described that. He said that his subjects rebelled and moved away. They would no longer live under his authority and realm. Apparently, he was not a very good king.
Show them how to provide for themselves.
What he's saying is he kicked them out of his kingdom.
Well, I mean, if we're just going off if we're just going to assume that this is a good king and not a lousy king.
We're not assuming, we're saying.
Because if you, I mean, you can look at a king who usurps authority, does what he wants, and the people will eventually rebel against that. We've seen that even in the not too distant past. You know, even in today, if the leader does not lead well, the people will rebel. Bad leadership leads to one thing, revolution. But if he does it well, they'll follow him straight to the gates of hell and back. If he does it well. My old man said, I was never a good leader. My men made me a good leader.
Okay.
Resolves conflict?
Sure, that's part of the justice thing, right? Where does conflict come from? Conflict comes from one of two sources. Either you broke the rules of the kingdom, in other words, you violated the king's authority, or, in the case where there wasn't a particular rule, two of you are not agreeing with each other. And so it becomes the king's job to do what? Arbitrate and mediate justice. So remember, the king makes the rules, and then the king would then have to arbitrate and mediate between those who aren't following the rules or aren't practicing them well. Okay, I think that nicely sums it up. Now, Jesus describes this situation. He says, the kingdom of heaven. But way back in Genesis, we see instituted the concept of free will. So how do free will and kingdom coexist? See, it's an interesting dynamic that rarely occurs well.
Well, that's what I was going to say. They can coexist, but now that the arbiter has a bigger job. You know what I mean? Because if the king is so absolutely staunch in how he leads, no one would dare break the rules for fear of retribution of some sort. So they wouldn't dare enter out into their own, sort of venture out into their own ideas.
Free will would exist under a good king.
Well,
bring me a little more of that.
The other side of that is that if he does it so well, they don't want to break the rules. They want to do what he tells them to do because he's so good at it, because he treats me well, because things are, you know what I mean? For us, I think it works the same way. As Christians, when life is good, we don't want to break the rules. Life's good. Things are going great. But when life turns and it gets harder, the rules are harder to keep. And I'm not thinking about the rules so much as my own comfort or my own issues or my own thing. Like I turn
I start to do what I want to do. Why? Well, kind of like in the movie last night. Well, what's God done for me lately? My mom's gone, this one's gone, I'm alone. So what's God done for me lately? So if you're not grateful for that protection, for that authority, you will turn to your own devices.
What makes any one of us subjects in the kingdom? We have free will. The king has authority. So what makes us subjects?
Well, there's a difference between subject and citizen.
Okay.
A subject is someone who is absolutely led by that person, that person alone. They don't even have an opinion.
Well, okay, that is in the same sense as how you define servant. Servant and subject may be two different things, but there is a broad spectrum of that definition. A subject can be one who simply grovels at the master's feet, or a subject can be one who has been entrusted with a certain amount of authority. But at the end of the day, we have two things here: authority and free will, king and subject. What determines if I am going to be a subject? Because, Jim, you said if a king does it well, no one would want to not live under his rule. Is that true? Now, I'm not saying that what Jim said isn't right, ideally. It sounds noble, right? How many times have people in the past tried to build utopia in one form or another based on what? The assumption that if everything was to people's satisfaction, that no one would break the rules. No one would. But
there's always one.
So at the... Again, we come back to this thing. What makes a subject, given these four things? King with authority, subject with free will, what makes a subject?
He has no authority.
He follows the king's authority.
Because
there's a buy-in.
It's completely voluntary, isn't it?
Choice.
It is a choice. I will remain under the rule of this king, or I will willingly come under the rule of this king. But what a paradox. Now keep in mind, at the time when Jesus uses these words, the kingdom of heaven is like, it's not as if there was a great deal of variety of rule. There were good kings, there were bad kings. As a matter of fact, Jesus says, and we'll look at that verse, that the kings or the rulers of the Gentiles tend to heavy-handedly rule over them, a lot of times with their own benefit in mind. So when he uses the term kingdom of heaven, he uses the idea of king and kingdom, familiar concepts. They're not really familiar with democracy. The role of the people, where the people choose a leader, and if they don't like the leader, they simply vote him out of office and put that. That's all foreign to them. The Greeks have only attempted to experiment with some very limited form of that up until this point. So they live under subjugation to Rome, and even at that time, there's all sorts of evil and vile stuff happening in Rome. You have to appreciate how new and how fresh Jesus' idea of rule is. As a matter of fact, when the people, Moses says to the people that he's led out of Egypt, you know, the time may come when you would choose to elect a king. And when that time came, what's God's response? He says, you really don't want to do this. But if you want to do this, fine. Have it your way. Now just think about this. What king, because God says, I will be your king. What king says, fine, if you want another king, I'll give you another king.
But here's how it's going to look. Here's what's going to happen.
Well, in today's language, you should let me script that out for you, and he does script it out for him, and then when it does turn out, it's just like when you say that to anyone, let me script this out for your teenage daughter, your teenage son, let me just tell you how this is going to go. And then it goes that way, and they come home and say, what did I tell you? I told you it was going to go like that. I told you that's what was going to happen. And they'll still choose to go, and the next time you say it, they'll have to learn for themselves, have to learn on my own. Most people, I don't really think, want wisdom. They want knowledge. It's a difference.
We'll get into that when it comes to the topic of repentance. You've introduced a really good point. Okay, so what we're going to do here is we're going to look at a couple of things in which God gradually, through some scriptures, we're going to see what God's basic idea is. Turn over first to Psalm 50. I know the Psalms seem like a strange place to introduce historical ideas, but... All right, so Psalm 50, and we're going to start at the 7th verse. Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against you. Now, let me back up here. Let's start at verse 4. He calls the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my faithful ones who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. What do you see there? This is God talking with his people. Remember, subject, what does he say?
He talks about their responsibility, their cooperation, their part in this relationship. Not just his. He calls them first, but then he says, here's...
And he says a covenant, meaning what? What have the people agreed to do?
Well, I have a different...
Go ahead.
...translation. It says, he summons up heaven and earth as a jury, which we all... Well,
okay.
What that is. He's taken his people to court.
Uh-huh.
Round up my saints who swore on the Bible their loyalty to me.
You have like New Living or something?
The Message.
Oh. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. It implies the same basic idea. Yours says they swore an oath?
They swore on the Bible their loyalty.
Okay, so what does that mean? The subjects have committed to live under the authority of the king. So who places the subject in subjugation?
Well, if you go to the next verse, it tells you. The whole cosmos attests to the fairness of this court, and there God is judge.
But notice, God has not imposed his will on people who did not first say, we want your will.
No, he says that the whole cosmos attests to the fairness of the court, of which God is the leader. Fair court, people like, all right, this is fair.
So point number one, in the kingdom of heaven, God restricts his power. He reigns in his power. This is the amazing thing about it. If you are an all-powerful king, what's the likelihood that you're going to let your subjects limit your power? If you're an all-powerful king, what is the likelihood that you are going to let your subjects limit your power?
Every king can look down through history and see what happens when you do not give your people at least a little bit of rein.
But we're not talking about a king here who has to worry, as in the sense that his people could rise up and overthrow him. If you were all powerful, what would be your motivation for giving your subjects
praise,
worship, and what more?
Adoration. Everyone loves the king. The king is awesome, gracious,
merciful. Let's read further then.
There we go.
Because this king desires something more than subjugation. He says, I can make you obey. I don't have a problem with that. I have ultimate power, ultimate authority. I can make you obey. But that's not what I want to do.
Yeah, he's the king who puts on the robes of a homeless person and walks the streets to find out what the people think.
Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God. Not for your sacrifices do I rebuke you. Your burnt offerings are continually before me. In other words, they're going through the motions of this. I will not accept a bull from your house or goats from your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. Remember what we said a king needs? He needs two things. He needs subjects and he needs territory. What's God establishing right here?
He owns the whole place.
Right. I have this.
Yeah.
I don't have to take it by force. And more than that, why do I have it? I have it because I made it. God is the only king in the universe who made his territory. So there's no question about it. It is mine. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle of 1,000 hills. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine. And so, if I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and its fullness are mine. What's he saying then? Remember the question? The king has to ask, what will be the value system of my kingdom? Will I live to pursue the good of my subjects, or is it the goal of my subjects to live to pursue my good?
Well, if you have if you have the king that is doing well and provides for all of your needs and the provision is there, that's what you're going to do. It's human nature to do that. At some point, when a subject realizes that maybe I can provide for my own needs and wants to step out, he may even go to the king and say, you know what, I just think I can do this on my own. And he might say to them, good, here are my boundaries. You can go outside of my boundaries, feel free to do whatever you want outside of my boundaries, but inside of these boundaries, we live like this. You want to go and do that? That's awesome, go and do that. He doesn't put him to death, he doesn't make him subservient to him. You know, he might do that. Okay, great. But for the most part, if he's meeting the needs, people are good with that.
Right now, let's return to the idea of authority here. Keep in mind the idea of kingdom and what we said. How does a king acquire a kingdom? By force or by bloodline? Does a king, throughout all of history, can you think of times when kings used their subjects to acquire territory?
Sure. Pick one.
What does that look like?
War.
So what is God saying? As compared with the kings of the earth who might choose to acquire their territory by using their people to get things for themselves, God is saying, because I already have everything, you can rest at ease. I am not going to use you to get what I want because I already have everything I need. Now that should be very liberating to every one of us. And so instead he says, if I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and its fullness are mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? What's he saying there?
I don't get hungry, I don't get thirsty.
And not only that, what he's saying is, you have, listen to what he says above there, it's not for your sacrifices that I rebuke you. Meaning what? They're being extremely faithful at this point to bring their sacrifices in. So what's he challenging them to think through? You don't bring your sacrifices to me because I'm going to go hungry if you don't bring them. I'm not desperate and on the verge of starvation, and I really hope that somebody's going to bring a sacrifice into the temple tomorrow, otherwise I'm going to starve to death.
No, the next verse says what he wants.
Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and perform your vows to the Most High. And keep in mind what he's just said. Who owns the cattle on the 1,000 hills? So when I bring the bull as a sacrifice, whose bull have I actually brought?
His.
So he says, I don't need the things that you bring to me, but instead, and we're getting down to what John said there, offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and perform your vows to the Most High and call upon me in the day of trouble and I will deliver you and you shall glorify me.
Now it just says, I'm going to take care of you right there. Fall on me.
And God, what God is assuring them is, you can be positive that I don't have ulterior motives in mind, because I don't need you to get what's already mine. I own everything, I have everything, there is nothing. As a matter of fact, if I wanted more, what would I do? I'd make it. But to the wicked, God says, what right have you to recite my statutes or take my covenant on your lips? And it returns to that idea of covenant. So in this, what God is saying, if you, the subject, make a covenant with me, your choice, you don't have to, what Jim said, if you want to live outside the realm, you can live outside the realm. If you choose to live in my realm, and you choose to make a covenant with me, what can you be assured of if you hold up your end of the covenant? That I'm going to care for you. But to the wicked, God says, what right have you to recite my statutes or take my covenant on your lips? For you hate discipline, and you cast my words behind you. Now I ask this question, what makes a subject a subject? And we never really got a clear answer on that. It is one who is willing to live under the rule of the authority. Now, somebody said, well, if the king is good and he does the right things, then the subjects will want to. So what distinguishes a subject is the fact that when the subject and the king disagree, whose will does the subject honor? Right. You're not really being a subject when you and the king agree. You're only being a subject when you say, well, I don't. If I were the king, I wouldn't do it that way. But you as a subject say, but I'm not the king, and I've made a covenant with you, therefore I will submit to your authority. And so my free will, you see the way this works? God limits his free will, and we have to limit our free will. As subjects of the king and sons or princes of the king, which we're going to get into in a minute, each of us has a responsibility in this covenant to limit our free will. And so what's really amazing here is the king is teaching us how to live with free will.
That's good.
Let's turn over to Psalm 72. Some of these are not going to point out that much more than we've already covered, but it's okay. So we're at Psalm 72. Give the king your justice, O God, and may your righteousness and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. All right. So now there's a new idea that's introduced here. Who are the three players there? Three sets of players. Let's read this again. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and the poor with justice. There's essentially three, you might want to call it four classes of beings there. Who are they?
God, his son, the poor.
Okay. God.
What is it? The son.
The son. Now, where do you get... Now, read me your translation.
Where are you at?
Psalm 72.
72.
This is like a prayer, so...
Where are you at in that?
First verse.
Give to the wise woman the king, O God.
Okay, so the first one, God. We got one.
Give the justice to the crown prince.
Two is the king, the earthly king, or you said crown prince. Okay. If we want to say there's three classes of people, we have God, we have the king. The king's people is what I'm taking this to be. Let me read this out of mine again, and then if somebody has a good alternate translation, we'll go to that. Give the king your justice, O God. Two people talked about. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. Okay, so if you want to classify the people into two classes, you could say that there are the regular people and then there are the poor, which deserve special attention. John, do you have a slightly different translation that makes...
I have the New King James. Give to the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son, and he will judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice.
Okay. Lineage. It's an interesting addition to there. Same principle. So in God's mind, what would he want then? God says, if you want people to rule over you, if you want people to lead you, then here are their qualifications. The king is going to rely on God.
That's the assumption.
And in turn for that, what is the king expecting that God is going to give him?
Wisdom.
Wisdom and righteousness to make fair judgments. Have you ever disagreed with somebody else's judgment? And so what the king is saying, because doesn't every king live with a certain amount of disease? Have you ever noticed that whenever you look at any kind of a kingdom, there's usually a castle? What's the purpose to the castle?
To
If all is good,
to protect the king from his subjects.
If all is good, there is no the king could live in a beach house, couldn't he? Kings live in castles for a reason.
With a moat.
Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor, of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. Alright, so we've seen the relationship. God, king, people. Let's continue with the prayer with what I just read. What are some of the expectations of a righteous king? What should the people be able to expect from a righteous king? It's right there.
He's going to take care of them.
Okay, so he's going to look out for the poor.
Prosperity.
Yes, he's going to seek more than just, okay, if you're really destitute, I'll give you a morsel of bread. The king is going to consistently be looking out for the prosperity of the people. Anything else? And finally, protection. Remember what we're talking about, the kingdom of heaven. Why do we need protection?
Let's talk about outside forces, all the crap that's going on in the world. So if we follow those laws, we can get away from all that. Push that aside. I don't know if you're saying it right. Push it aside. Keep our eyes focused on what we're supposed to be doing, the right things, and that other stuff will go away.
The implication is what? The implication is that there are those who not only don't want to live under the rule of this king, but what else? Remember what we've said? How does any king acquire territory?
Well, go to the land that I will show you and take it. You can't. There's giants in there. What did I tell you? Go get it.
And so the good king is looking out for the disenfranchised in the population. The good king is seeking the prosperity and the benefit of all. And the good king is seeking to protect his subjects, his citizens, if you will, because not everyone looks favorably on this kingdom. They would like some of this for their own.
Look at the kingdom of God. If all he wants is praise and there's nobody to praise him, be a problem. So I'm going to protect those that praise me above everything else.
All right, let's turn over to Psalm 110.
I mean, the state of Israel should have been gone years ago. According to statistics, every one of those little countries in the Middle East wanted them gone. Why are they gone? Because the king protects the people.
Before we read this, it says the Psalm of David, think for a little bit, whatever you know of Israel's history, did the people ever long to have David back as king, or someone like David? Were the people always happy with those who ruled over them?
No.
And so there are times when we say that the subjects would like to return to the rule of a former king that was better because this new king isn't as good. Just hold that in mind. That we would like a king that is consistent in rule. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool. Okay, how many people are involved here? Running out of board space. Remember these? Protection, prosperity. We didn't even add justice there, but how many people are involved there? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand.
So you have God, really the Father, the Creator.
Okay, so there we go. Father. And?
Then you have the Messiah. That's what it's just talking about. The Lord.
All right, let's move on. The Lord sends forth from Zion, and this is God here, God sends forth from Zion your scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. In other words, if we use this in Kingdom of Heaven language, not everybody wants to be led by this king. Not everybody wants to live under the rule of this authority. This is important. So we think that if things were utopian, who wouldn't want to be there? Remember what we've already looked at. God has modulated or regulated His power and authority, and in certain ways limited it based on our free will. And in turn, He expects us as subjects to limit our free will. Here's a different way to say it. Not everyone on planet Earth is willing to limit their free will. Some people's limits or extensions of free will are, I will do everything that I can, everything that I want to, until I am stopped. Now, what limits that person's free will? Somebody else's power, right? The only thing that gets in the way of the unregulated free will is a power greater than itself. What does that mean? There's going to be clashes. There's going to be clashes of authority. So God says, if we are going to live in peace and harmony, remember what one of the objectives was for the king? Prosperity. Have you ever seen a country, can you think of a place in the world even right now, where prosperity doesn't exist because the people cannot get along and agree to one set of rules?
Doesn't exist?
Can you think of a place anywhere in the globe where because people don't get along, they don't prosper?
Many.
Huh?
Many places.
Yes, many places. So you see, unregulated free will is the enemy of prosperity. That doesn't seem right, does it? You cannot have prosperity if everybody gets their way because no two people's way is identical. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies, so that we've established that there will be those who oppose this. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power. So look at the people's response. The same as there are people who will rise up and oppose God's rule, there are people who will willingly say, I choose to live under this authority. I delight to live under this authority. Why would a person delight to live under authority?
Because they agree that that suits them.
That's good.
And I think if you take it further, the relationship with that king is one that they not only see is going to benefit them, but realize that they're doing the right things, and they're willing to accept not only the consequences of falling outside that authority, but they're willing to accept the benefits of what that relationship is eventually going to bring.
Okay, so there is good in the present with the promise of better in the future. And because of that, I'm willing to subjugate myself. And isn't that what God's asking? The moment that God has to exert His authority in order for us to obey, is that the kind of God that we want to rule on or to live under? It's not. And so God says, if you want to find my rule favorable, then yield to and trust me at those times when you disagree with me. Show of hands, how many have disagreed with God at least once? Let me get the sentence done at least. The Lord has sworn and will not change His mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Okay, we get back to the messianic thing. Remember we asked the question, do people ever desire to return to the rule of a good king because they now find themselves under the rule of a bad king? You said that there is hope for a better future. But there can only be hope for a better future if we know that a good king is going to continue in power. If there's one thing that we can say about Israel's history, but it's repeated throughout all of human history, because Israel's history is human history, and human history is essentially pretty similar, no matter who the people are, no matter who the actors on the stage looks pretty much the same. Here's what we can say. There might be a good leader for a while, but what happens over a period of time within a bloodline? Things usually go downhill, don't they? Because the same driving, motivating force that compelled the first king of a bloodline to lead for the good of the people, and as a matter of fact, because maybe it is those people who helped that king acquire his authority, that dissipates with time. Today we see it this way. Today we see it, the first generation builds a business, the second generation isn't quite sure what to do with the business, and the third generation liquidates the business. Why? Okay, it doesn't always happen that way.
Well, that is true.
It wasn't their desire.
It's not the same desire, is it? No. Because for the third generation or the second generation, what is the business about? Money. What can the business, what can the people in the business do for me? What is the first generation? Sometimes. The good business? How can we together grow and thrive and prosper? And so, can we, John, have hope for future good rule if the king will not live forever? That's a problem, isn't it? The good ones die, and then what are we stuck with then? See, we can't have any hope for the future if we don't have a king that is going to live on in perpetuity. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So we have, again, God. We have a, now we're going to say, Messiah king. And we have the people. This is the model of the kingdom of heaven. So what does a priest do? The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. That's uppercase. In other words, God. This is God's decree. God has sworn and will not change his mind. You, the Messiah king, are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. So what is God's objective here?
Keep things going.
And? He's a priest. So God says, I have appointed you, given you all earthly authority. You are a king forever. But what's your primary concern to be? What's a priest to do? He's to bring the needs of the people back to God. And so this is the function of the Messiah receives power and authority from God. He receives wisdom from God. He rules the people carefully. All the things that we've already talked about, what are people looking for in a ruler? And he intercedes back to God on behalf of the people. Why? Because God himself cares about the people. And because God himself cares about the people, he puts someone in a position of authority who understands the people and yet understands him. The Lord is at your right hand, and he will shatter kings on the day of wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. Well, that's pretty bleak, isn't it? Why? Because he's not forever going to rule in the midst of the enemies. Do you have somebody next to you that lives maybe near you that you don't like? Have you ever lived next to a neighbor that you wish would move away? Or have you ever contemplated moving away because of the neighbor that you live next to? Okay, now, imagine that you knew for a fact that that condition was going to go on forever. All right, Next year I'm going to have to look at Joe's dog. I'm going to have to listen to that dog bark in the middle of the night. I'm going to have to, whatever it is. His trash is going to be blowing across my yard. His kids are going to be playing music loud at 2 a.m. Whatever it is. Your worst nightmare of a bad neighbor. What do you want to happen? Him to die? Okay. Yeah.
Either that, or you move. You vote with your feet, and you leave.
Okay, but here's the interesting thing. If you're the king and it's your kingdom, do you move your kingdom just because you don't like some of the people who still occupy it? So what do you ultimately do? For the good of the noble people, the subjects who have agreed to live under your rule and follow your rule, what do you have to do with those who consistently oppose your rule? Yes, you are. That's a nice word, isn't it? It's kind of neat and clean and tidy, isn't it?
By their personal choices and lifestyle, they themselves have chosen not to be a part of this kingdom.
He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter the chiefs over the wide earth. And then he will drink from the brook by the way, which is an odd saying. And therefore, he will lift up his head. And the lift up his head is a triumph. But what is the drink from the brook weirdness about? But there's something else. If you're in the midst of battle, do you stop and take a drink? Do you stop and take a long, refreshing drink? Kick back, smell the breeze while you're in the middle of the battle? You don't, do you? Thirst doesn't even enter your mind, or if it does, you push it back down because there's still war to be waged. And so what's being assured here is that he lifts up his head because what? There is peace. He is triumphal. He has overcome, and therefore everyone can live in the refreshment of this king's triumph.
It's already settled. It's a better
life. All right, now we'll turn over to Isaiah 32. I hope that this is not too much scripture. I apologize if it is. I'm really trying to get somewhere with this. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness. We're at the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, verse 1. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness, and princes will rule in justice. Each will be like a hiding place from the wind and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in dry places, like the shade of a great rock in a weary land. Then the eyes of those who see will not be closed, and the ears of those who hear will give attention. So who's introduced here? And? Huh? How many?
Watch.
Says princes, right?
Yeah.
Not princess, princes. Many, many of the male variety. Don't be smirking at me again. Come on.
The translation here is rulers.
I like rulers better. Each will be like a hiding place from the wind. Okay, so in that scenario now that's being introduced, who are the princes? Because before everything has been singular. We've had God, we've had a single Messiah king, and then we've had the people.
Do you think on a stretch that could be considered churches?
Well, who is a prince? Remember what we've established?
The sons.
The sons of the king are the princes. Who are the sons of the king? At that time, they're not maybe clear on that, who the sons of the king are. The sons of the king ultimately proved to be us. Ron, you didn't save that. My whiteboard is falling apart.
Anyway.
There we go. So how many of you like to be called subjects?
Probably not.
Okay, it doesn't. How many of you would like to be called princes?
Oh, that's much better.
Doesn't that feel better? Subject, prince. I want you to leave here today feeling as if you are princes rather than subjects. Now, does a prince live under someone? Sure he does. But he lives under someone with position, which is different than living under someone just because they're stronger than you are. Each one of us, it says here, is going to be a prince. And what is our function there? See, now, don't get too excited. Is it?
That's right, I'll take care of it.
Is my board just? Even my board will not be subject to me this morning. What's our role here? It says, each will be like a hiding place from the wind and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in dry places. Okay, have you ever used the phrase, someone should do something about this problem? Okay, in a kingdom, who should do something about the problem? Just naturally, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
King.
Right, of course he should, right? It's his problem, it's his kingdom, let him do something about it. After all, he lives in the castle. But if we are all princes, if we are of the royal bloodline, if we are part of the ruling dynasty, then whenever we say the word someone should, what does that imply?
Here I am, Lord. Send me.
Isn't that exactly what it implies? Because while we assume that in a kingdom, the king sits back and lives the life of ease. Do you remember the last psalm we read? Where was the king? Out there in the battle, right? He was right there in the midst of the war between what was good and what was bad. And so we as subjects, now princes, in this kingdom, what's our role and our responsibility? We are not only representatives, but it's our job. Look at what it says. To care for and protect, right? Each will be a hiding place from the wind and a shelter from the storm. The fool will no longer be called noble, nor the scoundrel said to be honorable. The fool speaks folly, and his heart is busy with iniquity, to practice ungodliness, to utter error concerning the Lord. So the fool rises up and says, I know better than God. The fool says, I don't need the wisdom of God. I can live under my own wisdom. And instead, he leaves the cravings of the hungry unsatisfied to deprive the thirsty of drink. As for the scoundrel, the second category introduced here, his devices are evil. So the fool says, I'm going to live life on my terms, not anybody else's terms. And if other people get hurt in the process, well, they should have been wiser themselves. But what does the scoundrel do? The scoundrel takes that one step further. The scoundrel goes from, I'm going to do things my way, to, I'm going to get mine by imposing my will on you unrighteously. I'm going to take what belongs to you. The fool just says, I won't live under the authority of God. The scoundrel says, not only won't I live under God's authority, but I'm going to wreak havoc on all those who choose to live under God's authority. But he who is noble plans noble things, and on noble things he stands. So let's just pause there for a moment. Remember? Kingdom of heaven. If you really believed that you were a prince in the kingdom of heaven, how would you begin each day? What would be the question on your lips each morning?
What can I do as a representative of the king today?
And because you are a prince in this kingdom, aren't you part of the kingdom? You actually have a stake in the kingdom. And so what would your question be? It would not only be, how can I represent the king, but how can I improve the kingdom? What exactly is my realm of influence within this kingdom, and how would I seek to improve it or set things right that aren't now right? So remember the three things that we looked at that a king does? What does he have to do? He has to look after the needs of those who don't have all of their needs met. What's next?
Protection.
Protection is another one. He has to protect people from those things that might bring them harm. And the third one? To seek prosperity. That means, believe it or not, that we should not necessarily be content with what we have today. And I don't mean that materialistically. That we should not say, everything that can be done has been done. Every good that could be achieved has already been achieved. We can therefore sit and rest. So every morning, the princes in the kingdom would wake up and say, this kingdom is ours. It is our responsibility. There are people that are depending on us to rule and reign righteously. And therefore, it's a chain of command. What am I going to do? It's a chain of command. What am I going to do? Okay.
Instead of, what are my desires, what are my needs, what are my interests, how can I help someone else? What are their needs? What are their interests? That's part of prosperity. In order to prosper, you need to go beyond your own personal desire.
Where do I get the wisdom to do that, though? Okay, so first off, I have to immerse myself in the constitution of the kingdom. I know constitution and kingdom don't necessarily fit together, the bylaws of the kingdom, whatever you'd like to. I have to immerse myself in them just so that I understand the general rule of law of this kingdom. But what else? I'm a prince. What do I have access to? Right, I have access to the king. Like some people don't have access to the king. What are the two things that I access the king for? At very least, what are the two things that I access the king for? Wisdom for how to exercise authority in my realm. But also, remember what it said of Melchizedek? This priest king who's going to live forever. What does he do? Why is he a priest? Because he's bringing the needs of the people to God. And so every day we come to God and we say, what are the needs of the people that you see that I don't? And give me wisdom, please, so that I can exercise your authority and reign in my realm well. But also then I go out into that realm and I see the needs of the people. And what do I do about that? I take them back to the king and say, we have situations in the kingdom that are not as would honor you. How can we start to improve this situation? How can we bring your righteous and just reign to bear in this deficient area? Now, just suppose that we actually did that twice a week. I'm being realistic. Just suppose we did that twice a week. I know that's not the way you all start your day every day. But do you suppose that a group of people who did that twice a week, who spent 10, 15, 20 minutes in God's presence and said, give me wisdom to function in the realm that you've given me today, and then at the end of the day we came back and we said, you should see what's going on in your kingdom. Let me give you a report. Not as if God doesn't know, but because how did we start today? We brought concerns of the people where? To God. God, your people are hurting. God, your subjects need some assistance. God, your people are worried. They need an extra dose of something that comes only from you and only you can provide. Now, what if we did those two things every day? Or twice a week, I said. I set a pretty modest goal. And what if we did that for 30 or 40 years? And what if it wasn't just you, but what if it was a whole church full of people?
Might make a difference.
It really could, couldn't it? And so the day that we stop saying someone should and start living like princes and say we will, is the day that things are going to perhaps change. But because we're intelligent princes, we know that we have an enemy. And so we're not going to get frustrated when things don't go smoothly and when things don't go well for us right away. Would you expect a diligent enemy to just say, oh, I guess he won that one? He'd almost be a disappointing enemy, wouldn't he? Not much of an enemy at all. So we should not expect it to be easy for us. What's the promise? That one day this is going to, the hope, one day this is going to be resolved. But in the meantime, we have a part to play. And if we sit back and we think that God and the Messiah King are going to make it all better and we're not going to play a part, I don't know, man. I think somehow we've missed out on our calling. You and I have one life here to live as princes, and it's our choice as to how we're going to live that life. Are we going to live with the expectation that the subjects owe us something? Or are we going to live as if our whole mission and purpose in life is to serve the people?